The Research Theme Park is a magical place in the Carlat Psychiatry Podcast. The showcases papers that are practical, playful, and reveal a little bit about human nature. Today we'll take you to a section of the park where nobody gets on the rides, but everyone feels like they're on them. Anxiety Land.
In today's episode, we'll walk you through seven recent papers that tell us something about anxiety. The first one tells us that people with anxiety would prefer to not relax if given the chance. This study took patients with generalized anxiety disorder, depression, and healthy controls, and taught them relaxation exercises. They then took the participants and had them watch videos that raised disturbing emotions. What they found was that people with GAD had more anxiety when they tried the relaxation skills. These patients are particularly sensitive to any change in their emotional state, and they might avoid relaxing to avoid the anxiety that comes with that change. In other words, people with generalized anxiety disorder might prefer to live with a low level of constant anxiety than experience the sharp bursts they get when they try something different, like relaxing. The same was true for the depression group, but just to a lesser extent. So does this mean that we shouldn't teach relaxation skills to our patients? Not at all. Those definitely work in the long term, even if they make things more difficult in the short term. What I take away from this study is that if you're going to try to teach those skills, keep in mind it's going to be really hard for the patient to do it on their own, and they might need more than a brief medication visit to do that kind of work justice. In my own experience, I often find it more helpful to guide patients towards environmental change during those brief visits. It's often easier to change your scenery than change your internal state. Walking in the woods has been shown to reduce anxious rumination, and urban dwellers might get that effect from a city park.
A walk in a city park lifts mood as much as Christmas can. Visitors who stroll through urban parks use happy words and express less negativity on Twitter than they did before their stroll. The improvement in their mood and anxiety lasted up to 4 hours after the stroll. The effect is so profound that it's equivalent to the spike in mood of Twitter's computers that register on Christmas Day, which is the happiest day of the year by Twitter's metrics. But if walking in the park doesn't work, try putting on a bike helmet.
A bike helmet suggests safety, even if the wearer is not sitting on a bike and the helmet cannot fulfill its function. This was a study on gambling, but it used a bike helmet. In this game, the players had to choose between a high-risk and a low-risk option. Half of the card players wore a bike helmet with an EEG attached to observe what was happening in their brain while they gambled. Bear with me here, we're not making this up. When the subjects wore the helmet, they felt safer and took more risks with the cards. What they measured with that EEG attachment tells us a little more about what was going on in their heads. It's an EEG wave called the frontal midline theta power. This is the brain activity we engage in when we're weighing risks and benefits, like when you're figuring out when to hold them, when to fold them, when to walk away, and when to run. Frontal midline theta power activity was lower when the subjects had the helmet on, implying that they weren't hedging and hawing over every possibility as they weighed those risks.
Compared to young adults, older adults are less distracted by negative information, even when they aren't wearing helmets. This next study looked at a trait called emotion-induced blindness, and this means the mind is too distracted by emotional information or disturbing images, like a picture of a man approaching a woman with a knife. Older adults actually prioritize this emotional information differently than younger people and are more attuned to positive information such as babies smiling and happy couples. This might explain a paradox in positive psychology that happiness levels follow a U-shaped curve across the lifespan, or you could call it a smiley face. Average levels of happiness in people peaks in their teens and declines through their 20s, It reaches its lowest level on the slide in middle age, but the curve starts to turn up again after age 50, and it keeps going up. Life isn't clearly getting better. There's medical problems, loss, insomnia, and immobility. But happiness keeps rising with age. Maybe it's because they're less distracted by all that negative information out there.
Just what are anxious people worried about? Is it losing something? Or is it taking on a risk? This paper from Biological Psychiatry used a sophisticated gambling task to find out. People with anxiety played a game where the odds could be changed. There were high-risk scenarios that had the potential for a big payoff, and there were other scenarios where there is a potential for a big loss. Compared to controls, what motivated the anxious players was not the size of the loss, but the size of the risk they were taking. In other words, they were just as bothered by the potential of a big loss as people without anxiety were. Nobody likes to lose, but they were way more reluctant to take any risks, whether that risk could lead to a loss or a gain. Dr. John Crystal, the editor of Biological Psychiatry, put it this way: nearly all life decisions involve risk. It appears that anxious people are hypersensitive to those risks, influencing their emotions, thought, and behavior. What that means in practical terms is this. It suggests that we should focus on encouraging anxious people to increase their tolerance of risk rather than dampening down their sensitivity to loss, rejection, and other negative outcomes. That was the conclusion of Dr. Caroline Charpentier, the lead author of the paper from the University of London.
The tricky part of working with anxiety disorders is understanding their psychology, even during a brief medication visit. People with anxiety are reluctant to make changes, take on risks, or accept uncertainty. And starting a new medication requires them to take on each of those steps. We close with some hopeful news about a medication we covered in our side effects issue last June. Metformin. Metformin is an anti-diabetic agent. That's often used to prevent weight gain on antipsychotics, but today we're going to be talking about what it might do for anxiety. In this study, metformin reduced anxious behavior in overweight mice and it increased serotonin activity in the brain. When the mice were raised on a high-fat diet, they had trouble producing serotonin because byproducts of the high-fat diet actually keeps tryptophan from getting into the brain. Tryptophan is an essential ingredient in serotonin production. In fact, a diet depleted of tryptophan is the most reliable way of producing depression in humans. So this is not a good situation to be in if you're a mouse on a high-fat diet. But there's good news. Metformin reverses this effect, allowing the serotonin to flow. In other studies, metformin has shown neuroprotective and antidepressant effects in animal models. But what do the human studies show?
This year, a clinical study from China looked to answer that question. They looked at depressive symptoms in 500 elderly patients with diabetes. They compared those who were taking metformin to those who were not, using a matched case-control design. The bottom line? Among these elderly patients with diabetes, the ones who took metformin had half the risk of depression. That's a big number, but we can't conclude entirely that it was due to the metformin, because case control is not as reliable as a randomized controlled trial, because it's impossible to control for everything without randomization. All of this good news about metformin's potential to help anxiety and depression might be limited, however. It seems to only apply so far to people or animals who have a poor diet, obesity, or diabetes. But then again, that's the kinds of patients that we use it for when we're pairing it with an antipsychotic to deal with antipsychotic-associated weight gain. Now, let me be clear, I'm not recommending that anyone take metformin just for anxiety and depression. It should only be used in psychiatry to deal with antipsychotic side effects. And when you use it there, the dose is 1,000 milligrams a day with food, starting at 500 milligrams a day for 1 week. There's more to know about metformin, and you can learn that in our June issue for tips on how to use it, whether to use the XR or the instant release, and how to manage vitamin B12 while using it.
As you exit the park, you will find some practical tools at thecarletreport.com. Today's visitors will receive $30 off their first subscription with promo code PODCAST.
Kelly, can you read the references for those 7 articles? Just the author's first name, the title, and the journal. I gotta go clean up in the funhouse.
And you, Kim. The Paradox of Relaxation Training. Journal of Affective Disorders, 2019. Aaron J. Schwartz. Visitors to Urban Green Space Have Higher Sentiment and Lower Negativity on Twitter. People in Nature, 2019. Barbara Schmidt. Wearing a bike helmet leads to less cognitive control, revealed by lower frontal midline theta power and risk indifference. Psychophysiology, 2019. Brianna Kennedy. Age Differences in Emotion-Induced Blindness. Emotion, 2019. Caroline Charpentier. Enhanced Risk Aversion, but not loss aversion, at Unmedicated Pathological Anxiety, Biological Psychiatry, 2017. Julianne Zemdegs, metformin promotes anxiolytic and antidepressant-like responses in insulin-resistant mice by decreasing circulating branched-chain amino acids. The Journal of Neuroscience, 2019. Fengkin Chen, risk factors for depression in elderly diabetic patients and the effect of metformin on the condition, BMC Public Health, 2019.